Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith, amateur radio operator W0NX, featuring the June 2024 The Spectrum Monitor. We'll begin by continuing Amateur Radio Insights by Kirk Kleinschmidt, NT0Z. More mentoring, more success. The helpful folks on the HP test equipment list at groups.io have been mulling over my situation. One recommended getting the above-mentioned SMD board, while others suggested that I check out a pair of steering diodes and measure voltages at several IC pins in the vicinity of the 10 MHz external signal input. To get access to the parts, I had to remove the unit's Hewlett-Packard interface bus, HPIB, PCB, an option that allows the counter to be controlled by external PCs and other test devices that speak HPIB, which loomed overhead, preventing access of any kind to the main PCB below. Removing the board turned out to be comically easy, but because the ribbon cable connectors were unfamiliar and exotic-looking, I had to figure out how to safely remove them without trashing the HPIB board in case I had to reinstall it when all was said and done. I didn't need the board, nor did I even want it, but because the HP5328A counter was supplied with many options, some of which required updated EEPROM chips, I couldn't assume that I could simply yank the board and be done with it, as my unit might then have the wrong EEPROM, the one that expects to see the now-missing HPIB board. None of that seems to be the case, but I didn't dare proceed until I had confirmation by one expert or another about the secret handshake required to unplug those exotic-looking plugs. After several days with no replies about that specific issue, I looked closer and applied just a bit more force than I had before. Of course, the plugs came right out. They weren't exotic at all, but they had been seated for 50 years and were sticky. I took pictures, of course, to help with potential reassembly, but now I had easy access to test the parts that were surely bad. I had sourced and cross-referenced the special diodes that HP used at the time, wasting plenty of time, and I discovered that the discrete logic DIP chip that sometimes goes bad was available from DigiKey. It was a relief that the bad parts would be readily available. Problem was that the parts weren't bad. Say what? But the folks on the HP group suggested that they go bad frequently, and Lady Heather said that the GPSDO was locked and operational. If these bad parts weren't bad, what could be causing the problem? Part of the GPSDO is dead, Jim. Because all sources suggested that the counter was the problem and not the GPSDO, which appeared to still be working 100%, in my troubleshooting haste, I forgot to connect an oscilloscope probe to the GPSDO's 10 MHz output to see if anything was there. And when I did, it was clear that the only signal present was some digital noise. There was no 10 MHz signal at all. So, the counter is probably fine? Could be. My new working assumption was that everything was fine with the GPSDO, except for the part that outputs the 10 MHz reference signal. The GPS receiver was fine. The one pulse per second clock output was fine. Lady Heather was fine. The only thing that wasn't fine was the actual reference output signal. But to get to that circuit, I had to remove the unit from its case, which was scary. The case was a hollow aluminum extrusion with end caps. And on these end caps are lots of connectors and indicators, RF, digital, and optical. I had been dreading this part, but because there was nowhere else to go, the unit had to come out of its case. In the online GPSDO forums, where I was now a registered regular, folks were describing how they'd casually pull the innards out without as much as a second thought. I tend to not take that approach in general, but my oddball model seemed quite a bit more complicated than the rest. Most had one PCB, while mine had three that were tightly stacked. I carefully removed one end cap, then the next. In the process, I had to remove the locking nuts that retain the four SMA RF connectors. This allowed the PCB assembly to slide straight out of a channel on the inside of the aluminum extrusion. But, like the frozen connectors on the HP counter, the force required to slide the assembly out was more than I was hoping for. It did come out, however, but in the interest of longevity, I vowed to never put it back in. More later. The output circuit is accessible. I had the GPSDO powered up and sitting on a piece of cardboard while I slid my static discharge wrist strap into place on my arm. The RF output connectors were on the top side of the topmost PCB in the stack. That was very helpful, because taking the sandwich apart would have meant dealing with ribbon cables and other fragile-looking connections that the manufacturer had to implement to get the thing together in the first place, using repurposed cell phone industry parts. I scoped the two 10 MHz RF output connectors, one sine, one square, and found nothing but a bit of random digital hash. The output circuit was bad, or had suffered an unintentional discontinuity. I had removed power to the unit because I didn't want to leave it overnight in its disassembled condition. As the unit was warming up from a cold start, I began probing various SMD caps and IC pins to see if I could find any sort of coherent signal. After a few minutes of not finding anything that looked useful, I again probed the sine wave output connector. Boom! There was a beautiful sine wave that my oscilloscope measured to be 10.00001 megahertz. I quickly looked at the square wave output. It, too, was beautiful and square. But just as I was preparing for a congratulatory pat on the back for fixing the GPSDO, the outputs disappeared into digital hash once again. What? The problem was the worst, a dreaded intermittent issue. I grabbed a screwdriver and used the plastic handle to tap on a couple of the chips near the output connectors. These taps would sometimes restore the sine wave output for a moment, or at least glitch the display to indicate that a coherent signal had been momentarily present. This behavior often indicates bad solder joints, a microscopic crack in the PCB, or even a really microscopic crack in the internal silicon of a chip, a cracked SMD cap or a resistor, etc. None of these things are desirable, as they are difficult to troubleshoot and they behave inconsistently, often with temperature or thermal stress involved. I again turned the power off and came back the next day. The thermal cycling phase happened again, as did the tapping behavior. I needed more online Elmering, so I went back to my helpers at a couple of online GPSDO groups before proceeding. Comically, as expected from a group of real experts, many helpers suggested that I simply design and build a new GPSDO from scratch because it was easy. It is true that all of the parts are now available at reasonable prices from Amazon, eBay, Temu, and AliExpress, but I wasn't looking for that level of personal learning just yet. Some helpers wanted me to apply freeze spray to the chips that I had been tapping on. I haven't had a can of that stuff on hand since the 1980s, but several helpers suggested that an inverted can of common compressed air, often used to blow out PC cases, etc., would do the trick and not destroy the ozone layer any more than would using a can of actual freeze spray, which now costs real money. I verified with YouTube. Yes, that's a thing, and I have several cans on hand. I did my best to apply the upside-down freeze spray with grace and precision, but because the parts are so tiny and the spacing so tight, not to mention the fire hose action provided by an inverted spray can. There was a decided lack of precision and a lot of associated component freezing. Moreover, the thermocycling induced by the spray replicated the power cycling and tapping effects. It was looking like one or both of the chips in the 10 MHz output circuit had bad solder joints, or were somehow cracked internally. They weren't, but the troubleshooting decision tree was sound. More later. By this time, having not yet killed the device by tapping, probing, and freezing, I started probing other circuit points nearby. In doing so, I discovered that both of the SMD resistors that set the input impedance of the small SOIC-8 chip that feeds the big SOIC-20 output chip sported a 10 MHz sine wave. By this time, I knew that the small chip was an op-amp and that the big chip was a signal routing and switching chip. If the input of the op-amp has the desired signal but its output does not, logic, my logic at least, dictates that the op-amp isn't amping, right? Yes, but ultimately no. This is a voyage of troubleshooting and discovery. The dreaded SMD. I have had the tools with which to make SMD repairs for about 10 years. I had never really used them, however, because my semi-senior eyesight isn't what it used to be, and the nerve damage in my right hand, master hand of course, is problematic when working at the microscopic level. I have laid in a supply of 1206 size SMD parts, the largest widely available, but I hadn't yet started to learn by doing. My aversion to doing so now, a trial by fire on a complicated device that uses parts that are much smaller than size 1206, was so great that I began thinking outside the box in a way that showed real promise. If I had a 10 MHz signal at the input to the MAX 4016 op amp, which I assume to be dead, why not just sample that signal right where it is, amplify it with an MMIC, and either reintroduce it to the existing output connectors, which also have small LC networks that presumably clean up and shape the output signal, or even give the newly amplified 10 MHz reference signal its own new LC network and connector. That would solve the problem and avoid the process of removing and replacing the microscopic parts, right? And I had already vowed to never return the unit to its original case, so an accessory circuit board wouldn't be a big deal. Surprisingly, my online Elmers agreed that it should work just fine, but they encouraged me to first simply replace the chips. To these guys, SOIC chips are big parts. To me, they were the largest small part that I could imagine successfully handling. I wasn't thrilled with the concept, but I decided that it was high time that I did something useful with surface mount parts, and that this would indeed be my SMD trial by fire. The GPSDO was already dead in a functional sense, and I could always replace it for the cost of a few Happy Meals or a bench or paddle. The parts were already in my DigiKey shopping cart, so I pulled the trigger. The op-amp weighed in at about $8, so I brazenly ordered only one, while the SOIC-20 output routing chip only cost a buck or so I ordered three, which turned out to be a good thing. Elmer's Goop. To replace the tiny chips, I had to first learn and practice non-destructively removing them, which required liquid flux, a hot air rework tool, some heat-resistant Kapton tape, a precision tweezers, and a devil-may-care attitude, which I did not yet possess when it comes to SMD work. Oh, and let's not forget the expert Elmering provided by 30 to 50 YouTube content creators. As mentioned, I had everything on hand, although I had previously used my hot air station only to shrink heat shrink tubing. My gold standard Kester solder paste had long since dried out, and all my fresh supplies had come from dubious offshore sources, many from Timu. I wasn't overly worried about this, because I had watched a bunch of experts on YouTube test the various offshore fluxes and solder pastes in head-to-head competition with the expensive name-brand products they're almost certainly counterfeiting. And they did just fine. Being completely inexperienced, I couldn't tell the difference anyway, so I simply forged ahead. As opposed to using a soldering iron with a tiny tip, the method I chose to remove chips and other SMD parts uses liquid flux, hot air, and a pair of tweezers. I thought about masking some nearby parts with Kapton tape to protect them from the heat, but in the end, I just let her rip. Contrary to polite etiquette, the liquid flux is applied liberally to all pins of the item to be removed. It sits there like a jelly spill, gooping up the area, until heat is applied from the nozzle of the hot air tool. I set my airflow control as low as it would go to minimize the chance of blowing parts off the PCB by accident. With goop, flux, applied, I introduce the chip, to be removed, to hot air from afar, gently circling the pins to be heated while not lingering in any one place to avoid hot spots, burning, or other untoward effects. When the heat gets into the business range, the flux relaxes and slathers everywhere in the vicinity of where it was applied. This is one clue that the solder originally used to attach the pins to the copper PCB pads will soon be liquid too. After making a certain number of gentle, controlled circles with the hot air tool, at the right moment a precision tweezers with long handles can be used to cleanly pluck the chip from the board. Any remaining solder on the now empty PCB pads can be removed with more flux and the application of copper braid heated with a conventional soldering iron. With plenty of applied liquid flux, this operation is surprisingly simple and effective. Without sufficient extra flux, you might burn up your PCB before the leftover solder is removed. You have been warned. Now, although the chip and any extra solder has been removed, the flux goop needs to be removed with a cotton swab soaked in alcohol or acetone. You will, of course, be adding more flux and/or more solder when you install the replacement part, but you want to remove this cruddy, already heated and oxidized chunk before moving on. I watched dozens of demo videos on YouTube before I started training by removing SOIC chips from an old, dead PC motherboard. I saw that it worked on TV, but I still doubted that it would work for me until it did. I plucked a dozen tiny chips from the donor motherboard before I plucked the two chips in question from the much smaller GPSDO PCB. I was nervous. I couldn't see well, even though I was using head-mounted magnification and my hand was shaking. I was almost certain that I would destroy the GPSDO, but I was in for a penny and in for a pound. New parts. Just like downtown, the copper braid, slathered in liquid flux, removed the old solder with ease, and my acetone-soaked swab, backed up by a paper towel, removed the flux residue. The newly naked parts of the GPSDO board were shiny and looking like new. Some techs use small diameter solder or solder paste, which also contains flux and is usually applied via syringe, and a soldering iron with a tiny tip to solder new SMD parts. I tried, but it was clear that the hot air methods were likely to work better for me. First, solder paste is applied to the PCB pads, one by one or simply as a line of paste that stretches across all of the pins on one side of an SMD chip. The new chip is carefully placed into the goop and positioned so that the legs line up as precisely as possible with their associated PCB pads. Once aligned, the goop holds the chip in place until you can set the point of your tweezers on top of it to make sure it stays in place. With chip legs stuck in the goop, apply heat in the same manner as before, starting a ways off and gently circling as you move the hot air nozzle toward the goopy legs. When the solder paste gets hot enough to relax, the magic really happens. Any now shiny solder that may have been applied between the legs of the chip magically flows to the metal chip legs and the metal PCB pads, leaving the spaces between free from solder. And if the chip is slightly misaligned, the process pulls the chip into its precise proper alignment. It's really weird. I soldered each side of my chips one side at a time. Is that proper? I guess so. If solder bridges remain after the initial solder flow, applying additional liquid flux, you guessed it, and heat from an air tool or a soldering iron, will dissolve the bridge. If necessary, really excessive solder amounts can be soaked up with copper braid. For me, remembering that this was my trial by fire, this process worked well, although I messed up the installation of the second chip, the big one, to the point where I simply removed it, cleaned up the pads as before, and reinstalled a second chip, which went by the book. Smoke test. More Elmer's stuff. After cleaning up the flux residue and letting the board cool a bit, the only thing remaining was to give it the smoke test. With nervous excitement, I connected the wires, hooked up the scope, and flipped the switch. Despite the new parts, everything behaved exactly as before. Tapping and freezing still caused intermittent function, although the length of time I could actually see a sine wave on the scope was even less than before. OMG, the chips probably weren't bad in the first place. This time, when I returned to my online Elmer's, a newcomer to the discussion casually mentioned that the MAX4016, although it is an op-amp, in circuits such as those used in GPSDO outputs, the chip is used as a comparator, a signal gating device. Gating conditions not met, no signal output. Conditions met, signal output. And configuring the gating function typically requires a variable resistor, a potentiometer. He suggested that, in order to output the signal, one of the pins had to show exactly half of the 5-volt supply voltage, and then I should adjust the mysterious potentiometer until my voltage readings agreed. At the time, the chip's voltage input pin measured 5 volts, but there was no DC voltage showing on any other pins. I had never seen an SMD trim pot before, and as I looked them up online, it was clear to me that they were extremely small. I switched on my cell phone's Super Magnifier app and scanned the PCB. There just couldn't be a trim pot in the vicinity, I thought, because I'd surely have seen it by this point as I had been tapping, freezing, and probing. But now that I had seen a photo online, there it was. The tiny, three-legged trim pot was not far from the freshly replaced MAX4016 chip. Previously, it hadn't even looked like an electronic part, but under magnification I saw the small screwdriver adjustment slot on top. I found a tiny ceramic micro-size screwdriver in a package of alignment tools I had purchased some 20 years ago, and I cautiously started turning and tapping the control. I immediately discovered that this was the thing that had actually been responding to previous tapping and freezing. The control seemed dirty or somehow non-performing, so I took a chance and applied a single drop of Keg Labs Fader Lube, a degunking solution designed to be used on potentiometers, to the tiny variable resistor. We'll continue this article next time. Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.